Hello, I'm Richard Cabe. I'm a speech language therapist and I also work at the Centre for Digital Language Inclusion. I'm co-director of that space and the goal is to make the world a better place for people who have difficulty being understood in whatever language they choose to speak.
Hello, I'm Cathy Holloway. I'm a professor of interaction design and innovation at UCL and I'm a co-founder and director of two things now, Global Disability Innovation Hub and the Centre for Digital Language Inclusion with Richard.
Well, I think CDLI started because you came and asked me if we could go and do a project in Ghana. Is that right? And you'd been working on the Google Relate app and it had been launched in Ghana and you thought that's interesting because nobody seems to be using it, but it could be quite useful. And we wondered if it could be useful. I think that's... And so we went to Ghana, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's it. And I've been doing a PhD on Project Relate in the UK, because Project Relate is this Google thing that only works in English. And I've been videoing people for a whole year and transcribing everything. And I'd come to the conclusion that there are some significant benefits here, not just from a technology perspective, but from a quality of life perspective, that people are being understood better. And in the world that I live in speech and language therapy, that with progressive conditions, when speech changes, then bad things happen. Because increasing social isolation, people question competence and change of identity, loss of identity. And so I really, really love this technology because it enables it. The way it works aligns entirely with what people, in my opinion, want, and that's to keep talking. So you have to talk to make this technology work. And so when working, because you were my supervisor at my PhD, thank you for that, we talked quite a lot. And while I was at Google, of course, they did this big launch of Project Relate in Ghana. And like you say, it's just like it went in Ghana and it disappeared without trace. And so on the one side, I could see real tangible benefits for people I work with in the UK. And it's gone to Ghana and it's disappeared without trace. And that was how the conversation...
Yeah, and I remember thinking to myself, well, I don't know anything about Ghana. I've never been to Ghana. So what are we going to do? And then remembered that we had a master's student on the MSc in Disability Design and Innovation, Derek. And I thought, well, he's Ghanaian. Or maybe he knows somebody. So we emailed him, didn't we? And he reached back saying, oh, there's a great speech and language therapist called Gifty. And we had that call with Gifty. And then I remember thinking, we've got no time to do this. I can't remember why the timeline was so short. It might have been budgets, I can't remember. But I remember reaching out to Julia Barbareski, who was in Japan then, and saying, Julia, I've got no money to pay you, but I think this is a really good project. Do you want to help with the ethics and the protocol and we could all go to Ghana for a couple of weeks? And then when we landed, of course, Gifty had found 10 speech and language therapists and you brilliantly trained them in how to use Relate. And then they went off and used it with 20 clients. And you flew up to the north of Ghana as well, didn't you?
Yeah, Tamale.
Yeah.
The really good thing, I mean, there are so many good things about back then. I mean, it was just good fortune and willingness. I mean, you found something from somewhere, from behind a settee or something. And Julia, who I didn't know, but I got to know very quickly, was more than happy to get paid nothing and fly all the way from Japan. But the whole thing about it was that it was grounded in function. That we worked, thanks to Gifty, we worked with people and people with impaired speech. People, professional speech and language therapists and people with impaired speech. And so what we were doing was more than just some research. It was about what does actually happen, what actually happens in function and, you know, kind of putting that together with 10 pence and the best will, you know, I just thought it was really nice. Because, you know, when we think about where Project Relate has come from, from a multi-billion big tech company. Our work, our tiny little piece of research there, was the first anywhere where there'd been research on actually, well, how does it work?
Mm.
And what happens, other than the PhD, in which wasn't published then?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think a lot of technology gets launched these days because it's so easy and quick to develop and launch. Mm. And the excitement's all in the AI-powered launch.
Yeah.
And then it's much harder to get money and funding to do the studies on how is it actually absorbed by people into their lives, and also then to feed that back. Because I think the one thing I will say about Google is when we did that study, and it wasn't, you know, it had some things which said, yes, this works really well, and then a series of recommendations about how, you know, why is, if it works well for some people, why aren't you launching it in other countries which speak English? Second one being, not everyone speaks English.
Yeah.
And, you know, why only in English? And then the third one being, you know, it will pick up phrases like hamburger, no problem, but it won't pick up jollof rice. It has no local, so people are having to spend their energy, which is very limited sometimes, recording custom phrases, which are sort of obvious for the cultural context. And so why wouldn't they be built into the model in the first place? And in fairness to Google, they listened.
Oh, yes.
They did. And they took it on board and thought, well, how can we support this? And I think the first bit of funding, that £10,000, was luckily enough, it wasn't quite under a sofa, but through the 80-20-30 programme, the UK government are actually a little bit flexible with us under this project line on future tech.
Mm.
For us, because it's future tech, you don't know what's going to come out. So, I can make a case for doing certain small projects.
Mm.
And so then Google come in, google.org, and have matched fund the project, which is brilliant. But it's also been a lot of work, because if you think about it, we've gone from that project and already having two full-time jobs to suddenly deciding we're collecting 10 African languages.
Which has turned into 13.
Which has turned into 13 African languages. We've on how many hackathons in Africa now? Tomorrow's our
second one.
Second.
Mm.
And then in a few months we'll do two more. Mm. And now we've just got the funding to roll it out in Europe as well.
Yes.
And to create the data application tool, the actual, make an open source version of Relate, basically.
Yeah.
And I think that's important maybe to think about, because how you collect the data, if we can collect all of the languages in one tool, then we can also begin to look at code switching between languages, as well as multi-language models, and see if they have efficiencies for people.
Mm.
So when next? So we've finished Africa. Not finished, but our funding finishes for Africa, so we need more funding to do more. We move on to doing Europe and potentially India.
Yeah.
But what do you...
South America.
South America, Colombia, hopefully. And there's a possible conversation about other countries in Asia. But as all of these things come in, Richard, what do you think we should be thinking about as the next big idea within CDLI?
I think there are three things here. The first thing is it's working so well because it's a good idea. And the real challenge for us is to explain the idea as to why it's good and put it in human terms. And it just feels like this is a mission in itself. Just share the idea. Because when people understand, I'm absolutely certain, when people understand, then good things happen. Like you're going to see presidents and ministers in Asia. And I think, you know, if you're given the airtime to explain it, elevate a pitch, you know, maybe 5 minutes with them, then good things happen. The second thing is, where do we go from here? Is that we are building technology to collect recordings of people with impaired speech in a really easy and open source way. Because as we get busier, we can't be sequential. We have to run in parallel. So currently we're collecting, I don't know, we're still collecting, what, three or four languages in Ghana. Next week we're going to start collecting languages in Rwanda. And early next year we're going to start collecting languages in Europe. And, you know, from this point on, it's all going to be the same tool, all the same platform. And it just, and therefore, everything, the technology is supporting us, and it's down to us to do it in the right way, because we've kind of built the system kind of as we go along. Where next is that I agree with you that all the time we want to reflect how people communicate. And, you know, I live with, my wife is somebody that speaks multiple languages, and in phone calls, video calls with her family, she uses them all in the same sentence. And that's just how the world works. So this idea of code switching is now no longer the impossible problem or the convoluted problem where you have to switch apps or sources or whatever every time. That actually, it can be done. It's just a technical problem. So for us, building our technical skills based on our specialism, because I feel, when I look around the big tech world, we right here have the best chance of cracking this nut. And I'm understating it, because what I'm talking about is how people communicate, you know, wherever they are. And, you know, it was just a joy to be up in northern Ghana, Tamale, to help this young lady with cerebral palsy who is so difficult to understand and has been struggling all her life. And finally, there is something that might help her. And so, you know, telling her story along with all the others go on.
No, I was just thinking as you were talking about Radia that one of the things that strikes me is once we've got the models and we've got the people using, you know, tech, there's also, you know, we've got a lot of startups or a lot of ventures coming up with ideas and some of them are excellent, really excellent. I mean, that team that have got it embedded into all video calls, Google Meet, Zoom, Teams, you know, and I love that. I love the fact that when you're working with young people, there's not they're not doing it for one platform. They're thinking, well, we're going to embed it into messaging, so we're going to use Telegram and Signal and also WhatsApp.
Yes.
And so that's also something quite nice about working outside one big tech, is that they're looking for solutions that are agnostic to the hardware that's being used and the software that's being used, which I think is really important. Mm. But the other thing I've been thinking about is the systematic influencing. So if we think about banks, so Asian Development Bank, for example, when I go to Manila in a couple of weeks, phone banking systems, those automated phone calls, are an absolute nightmare for people with speech impairment, right? It's very, very difficult to get through it. It often times out if you have a stammer or a stutter, or they don't understand what you're saying, and you've got to make sure you remember the right combinations of numbers to try and actually reach a human, at which point the human won't understand you either.
No.
So, and I think that's the really interesting thing. It's something that you and I have spoken about a lot, which is if anybody I ever meet who has a severe speech impairment or speaks very differently from everybody else, their loved ones or the people they share their lives with, they all understand them. There's not, they understand, they've learnt to understand them.
Yes.
So really, the disability, if you want to call it a disability, is in the hearer. I can't understand
completely.
That person. So actually, it's me who needs the assistive technology.
Yes.
Or at least the assistive technology is the mediator between this conversation. If we're trying to help the conversation, if the conversation is the
That's
thing we're
exactly
trying
it.
To support, then it's not about who has the disability. It's about the fact that we wish to communicate. And if you happen to be the person in the bank and I happen to be a customer of your bank, then this technology should mediate or support our communication in the same way as any other technology we decide to roll out within the bank, where we're trying to help customers engage with us and have conversations, potentially with or without humans. And I think how we get mainstream banks, banking's a really big one, shopping's a really big one, entertainment's a really big one, education, but also healthcare.
And employment.
You know, healthcare, when we had that high-level meeting at UCL and Keir Starmer mentioned that, because of AI, we've managed to find this stroke. You know, UK technology's managed to locate a stroke, exact location of the blood clot within 5 minutes or something, thereby saving lives. And I said to him afterwards, but that person probably woke up with a speech impairment.
Yes.
So nearly everybody who has a stroke that I've ever met wakes up at least with a speech impairment
Me
and
too.
Is immediately
not understood. Anybody who develops head and neck cancer, motor neuron disease at a certain degree. But all of these people, they wake up and we've got a healthcare system that's then got to provide for that person and we are unable to understand them.
Yeah.
And what if we just had this technology in hospitals?
Exactly.
And they could just speak and they would be understood and there would be no problem. And they would also, it would also help the rehabilitation process, because what you've got to do is start speaking, right? You've got to start doing the rehabilitation. And actually, as you're doing that, you could be training and using the model rather than not being spoken to by clinicians or being spoken, you know, carer or loved person being spoken to. And then all of a sudden, now you're doing your rehabilitation. Oh, you stopped your rehabilitation with your speech and language therapist. Now you go back to not being communicated with. And then a few weeks later or a few hours later, you're back here. But you have to keep switching roles because people don't speak to you because they're scared they won't understand you.
Yes, that's right. And I think you put it beautifully, that actually where the challenge is in the listener as opposed to the speaker. And, you know, there's so many people I know with impaired speech, difficult speech, but there's no direct link to competence here. You know, there may be some difficulties, but they're quite equally, there may be no difficulties at all. And I think one of the challenges we have is that AI and technology is moving so fast and people are making so many claims. I went to an AI summit with 11 Labs last week and I heard the same there, but I hear it in all sorts of places that, you know, voice agents and scribes and all this kind of stuff are revolutionising the industry, employment, health, whatever industry where people talk. There's an argument that using this AI-driven scribe voice agent technology is going to help people and actually make things move forward. And I think one of the most important things with the CDLI, along with all the other important things at CDLI, is to get ourselves a benchmark so that we can demonstrate in an objective way who is included with these voice agents and scribes and who is excluded. This is particularly important when you even think, in my profession, Royal College Speech and Language Therapists, they're advertising for scribes, this is voice agents, within speech therapy sessions as the next big thing, because it's going to save you as a clinician time and all the rest of it. And so for us, we need to help everybody understand what the limits of that technology is. And actually, I think that's something that we can do.
I think there's slightly separately to CDLI, but I think that this entire voice agent bubble that we're in, it's driven in some ways by the standard driving forces of our economies at the moment, which is efficiency and productivity.
Yeah.
So, fine. But from what I can tell, the more efficient we get and the more productive we get, the more burnt out we get and the more depressed we get. We seem to just not benchmark technologies off of the things that really matter to human beings. So if we come back to CDLI, what really matters is that you feel part of society. People want to belong. People want to have a voice.
Yes.
People want to be able to communicate and connect with people. And I feel like sometimes these technologies are brought in as a it's going to solve everything. But actually, yes, there are some bits of the chain where efficiency would be great and a bit more productivity would be great and a bit more time with the client because of that would be great. And equally, you were saying about it being brought in by the Royal College. I wonder how many people, if they have checked to see how many of their speech and language therapists themselves have a speech impairment and whether or not these technologies actually work for those people. Because I guarantee they won't have been trained on any impaired speech.
No.
And so a certain number of speech and language therapists will become totally isolated and left out. Whereas if you put it into, and this was my point to Kew at the time, if you put things into procurement from the very beginning, if any voice agent, if the UK government or the Kenyan government or any government was putting out a tender for anything, for healthcare, or a bank was putting out a tender, if there was a line in that that said, we expect this to include, impaired speech, then every company would collect impaired speech. And like all disability inclusive initiatives, collecting the data early on isn't difficult. It really isn't. We've shown how it's not difficult. We've managed to do it in many countries across many challenges, and yet we have the data sets. And once we have our tool out in next quarter, it will be easier still. Yeah. People can download it and start collecting their own models. So it's easy to do, and all of that data can be used by the big companies. It's freely available for them to incorporate into their models. You found in Google before, if you incorporate that impaired speech, it doesn't make models worse.
No, it doesn't.
It makes models better, slightly better.
Yes.
So the models only get better by including it.
Yeah.
The data's already there and is free.
Yeah.
So all the people actually putting out the procurements need to do is add a line. Yeah. And then it would work. And then we can still make bespoke solutions for people with impaired speech. But the mainstream technology would just be including people by default. And it feels like we're building a railway. This AI, all these like GPU servers out there, and everything's going very quickly. But it feels to me like we're building the equivalent of railways without ramps or without step-free access.
Yes, exactly.
And
that.
You would just never think in this day and age, oh, I'm going to build a whole new metro system and there's going to be no lift access, no step-free access, because you would think, well, that will exclude not only wheelchair users, but also prams. And obviously it's better for everyone if we have lifts, but we all carry luggage on occasion. And so you would just never do that. And yet that's exactly what we're doing in voice.
Happening.
And people can't seem to see that they are doing something fundamentally exclusionary, and probably breaking a couple of laws in some jurisdictions.
Yes, exactly that. And this line, which we talk about, that I will only accept your scribe or your whatever is agent technology versus another agent technology, if that your technology passes this, has a, say, 75% rating of inclusion according to the CDLI Gold Index, which we can, which our team are creating. Yeah. We will benchmark, and that benchmark could be the difference between getting stuff included or not.
So if we think about that, next year, this time next year, we come back to Nairobi, we sit in these seats.
Yes.
What will we have done, do you think, CDLI? What will we have launched or completed? A benchmark?
Definitely a benchmark.
A data collection tool?
Yes.
An open source relate app?
Yes.
How many language data sets?
Frankly, it depends on funding, but I would love to think that we're beyond 30.
Okay. And how many student entrepreneurs will we have got to the marketplace, do you think?
This is the challenge. We're not short of great ideas, because these students, we've given the opportunity and other people have given the opportunity to give them great ideas. The problem, it's always been the problem, as far as I can tell, is making sure we build capacity to just take it to market. I would love to think that out of 30 languages that we have 10 great ideas. Really, we should have one great idea per language. That would be, we've already had at least one amazing idea coming out of the first language in Ghana. And now what?
It's hard, isn't it? Because I think that people's natural model, especially if you're a young person in university, that people are being sold this idea of venture capital funds, and you start a company, and the issue with having one app for people who are speech impaired is that the market's not massive.
No.
So unless you're building a suite of tools, or unless you've got a model where you want to sell that into banking or somewhere else, you could begin to grow to maybe 100 to 200 users, get some very, very good data on why, this is being used by everyone, but a lot of people won't be able to afford it. They won't be able to afford a subscription model. So who's going to pay for it, basically, is the issue. And the other option is that you make it completely open source. Mm. That's quite hard to then keep developing.
Yeah.
Or you could license it to another company that's doing something which they can embed. Mm. They can embed these things in. But I do think one of the reasons we're going to try and start this app foundry is to try and support the business model of these micro apps.
Yes.
What is the business model to really make it successful? Because it probably isn't six developers full-time working on it.
No.
But it could be a smaller micro-business, and collectively they could be part of something that's really quite...
Yes.
Quite brilliant. But I still, like you, I'm not entirely sure how that's going to work. We've created that module for everybody, which is Idea to App, which is working well.
Yes.
And we're working very closely with the first winners to see how to best support them.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, they've got a great idea, like they're embedding that technology into to different languages and into different messaging apps. But again, do you try and knock on the door of Meta and sell it back to them? You know, or...
Why not? I mean, I think another really important thing that, you know, by this time next year that we will have this down is that we are really, that we will be known as really great influencers, not only to big tech, but the big tech is very important, but also at the governmental level and others. Because actually this story is not well understood because we haven't had the opportunity to explain it. And I think that, you know, if we do have a round table with Meta and Microsoft and Amazon and Google and Apple, that where we demonstrate something that actually works with us, that actually, you know, well, how about just integrating it? It's like none of us want a little app that sits in between, you know, that's on the phone. You switch on the app and then it talks to Siri. We want Siri just to work.
Yeah.
We just want it to work. And therefore, we are building the technology that shows it works. And what would be ideal is to partner with all these big tech companies, you know, do what Speech Accessibility Project is doing, but for the rest of the world.
Mm.
And just it just works. Just so you know, that is true inclusion to me, that I get my phone and it just works.
I think it would be good to maybe in the new year sit down with the winning top five teams and maybe chat with them about what's working and what's not working and see how we can strengthen what needs to be strengthened to support them.
Yeah.
Because I don't want their ideas to just be given to Meta or Apple or any of the big companies without them having some recognition, especially because if you look at, say, Kenya, you've got, is it upwards of 70% youth unemployment? So a lot of people are joining hackathons desperate to create a business, you know, some form of employment trajectory for themselves. So there has to be something where we can ensure fairness back to their idea and support them as well as getting it into the mainstream. And there has to be a way of doing that.
I think the climate is optimal for these groups. Because in big tech land, they're not allowed to talk about DEI. All these projects that are being offloaded. And yet all the people that could benefit are still there.
I know.
And so we have an opportunity for, you know, these master students to do something really great that we know the big tech companies are not doing because they're choosing not to do it. So there is this gap.
Yeah. No, there is.
Yeah.
Padding shot. We've been going for about 30 minutes. But so far we've done this in four countries now, right? Ghana, Kenya, Uganda, and Rwanda. You've been able to work with the partners in the different countries. What is it that you've learned that you didn't know before? And where does that leave us now moving forward?
So, Richard, we've been working in four countries.
We have.
I think the first country was Ghana, and we definitely learned a lot working in Ghana.
We did.
I think one of the things I remember is... So, we've now been working in four countries. We started in Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll name a couple of learnings from my point of view, and maybe you can add in. But I think... culturally, especially in Ghana, there was a challenge around the desire for using linguists as the translator or the, what's the word I'm looking for? Not translator, transcriber. Whereas they often corrected the speech into proper, you know, into correct English or into correct Ga, when actually what we want to do is whatever is said should come out.
Yes.
Not whatever is said is corrected, you know. So,
yes.
So there was that challenge, and I could understand why people would want GAR to look correct, but equally there was that challenge. I think there's also been challenges about ownership of data, and that was a big challenge in Ghana that we've not had in East Africa. So since we've been working with Census Hub, we haven't had any, we seem to have managed to work in a way where all the data's being collected by Brian Mwanda's team and local university partners.
Yeah.
And local universities have managed the ethics brilliantly, actually. And the data can be stored in one place. Because I think that was the other thing. Initially, we thought, wouldn't it be good if the language data stays in the country? Because it belongs to the country. But we hadn't really appreciated that that actually makes building the models and things incredibly difficult.
Yes.
And also, if we're then housing data in a lot of different countries, it gets quite complicated. So having it in one place does make sense, and ensuring then that it's available and it, technically the ownership is here, but you know it's available on the CDLI Hugging Face site. So I think the ethical challenges, just getting ethics approved, contracting challenges, but we've got over those. But in the everyday field, I think, what would you say?
I'd say, you know, that people with speech difficulty, people with disability, living with disability generally, have been quite hard to find.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
And we've relied very heavily on existing networks, either speech therapists, of which there are very few, or other networks like church or educational, to actually reach out to them. And the recording process has been challenging too, because, you know, we don't have studios here, we don't have quiet environments, and often we're recording in places where there's lots of traffic and bird noise and all the rest of it. And it's just from a practical perspective. The other thing is that we've come across very strongly that what is success here? And we had one program in Ghana where actually it was decided, not by us, it was decided to only try and record people with less impairment rather than more.
And it didn't even include people with Down syndrome?
No.
Or anybody with any sort of cognitive impairment, even a mild cognitive impairment. And that was, I think that's very challenging, because it also skews the data set to A, solving an easy problem, which makes the word error rate, which is what everyone cares about.
That's what they care about.
You know, it's what people care about, is word error rate. But actually, word error rate is just simply whether or not each word is correct. But as we know, as you've taught me, if I'm honest, you know, each word does not have equal value.
Exactly that.
I have a headache versus I have a head are two very different.
They're quite different.
They're quite different. And they you could are. Get had wrong, I have headache, and you'd still probably understand what I was saying, but I had head doesn't work. So I think there is this, and if we only, this is one of the reasons I think why impaired speech isn't included all the time, is because people are obsessed with producing models that improve the word error rate, not meaning preservation, not whether or not it's useful, because actually, as you've said many times, it just has to be good enough.
Yes.
I often get words wrong all the time.
Me too. That's part of being human.
Yeah. So it's okay for the technology to not be perfect.
Yeah.
But it does need to be functionally useful.
I mean, the most recent data set we've had in Ghana, more than 70% of all the recordings have been judged as either typical or mild. And so the rest of it, very few for anybody where, for people who may benefit from that model.
Yeah.
Because for people with typical and mild speech impairments, they don't need the tool.
No. But in Rwanda, Uganda and Kenya,
it's
completely different,
it's
right?
It's completely different, because
we've got a nice split.
We've kind of learnt from that not to assume anything. And actually, you know, kind of, word error rate is not the thing. Being understood is the thing. Being 100% accurate is not the thing. Getting on with life is the thing. And that's how we live, and that's why we're here. And you know, it's this word error rate thing is even in our own sphere, the Speech Accessibility Project, you know, recently ran a project where they were looking for improvements in word error rate. And it's just like, okay.
It's an easy thing to measure.
Yes, it's beautiful.
It's an easy thing to measure. It's like trying to measure, I don't know, weight versus well-being. You know, it's like, I can see why people gravitate to it. And it has useful, it is useful, and it's not, it's not everything.
No. I think there are two things there, three things. The first is that it's great that language changes, because that's just how we are, and we want people to speak the language in which they use. Even my language has changed because of just how things are. From an expressive perspective, in the tools that we're building, we can customise those models, and we can teach those speech recognition models to better understand the words that I actually use, as opposed to the words that are kind of on the system. Where it's harder is for the underlying foundational base models, which may not be keeping up to date. But that is a technical problem. Though, you know, first things first, it's like, let's enable people to say whatever the hell they want, including the words, the kind of new words,
The last thing that I want you to talk amongst yourselves now is, we've had partners, if it's possible, let us mention them in different countries, and then that should be it, then we can wrap it up in a nice way.
Yeah, so I think, like everything we do at GDI Hub, everything's been in partnership, right? And I think Ghana, you know, we've been very lucky to work with Gifty from Talking Tips. And the University of Ghana went off and collected the data for us, for GA and ACAN. And we have now released, I think, those data sets, which is great. And then I think once we shifted to East Africa, we changed the model a little bit. Previously, we worked, you know, with the university and Talking Tips separately, separate contracts. Whereas for East Africa, we decided to have one central contracting partner, which has been Census Hub.
Yeah.
And we deliberately didn't make it a university, actually. We made it a community innovation space that's dedicated to designing technology for disabled people and assistive technology. And that was, I think, strategically, that was so that we, when we were going out to communities, because you're saying it's very hard to find people.
Yes.
And I do think that universities, sometimes we look like we're going to research you.
Yes.
You know, we're going to analyse you. Whereas Census Hub is well known for not doing that, but providing solutions and bringing solutions to market. And also because we wanted to improve the pathways for the entrepreneurs. And Census Hub obviously have a great track record of that. And in fairness to Brian and his team, he has managed ethics and contracting with the with Strathmore University here in Kenya, with Makerere University in Uganda, and in Rwanda, the University of Rwanda. And it's all been seamless. And they, in turn, have found speech and language therapists.
Yes.
And we've also reached out to local communities through Census Hub to find participants. Mm-hmm. And it's worked really well. I think that model of having Census Hub as the main conduit for what we're doing is great, because it means a lot of the community and building, but also, you know, it's an African institution talking to other African institutions, and they are the central hub. And it means that we can get on with doing a lot of the very technical work on the language model creation. And equally, we've unearthed some brilliant young minds here, like Elizabeth.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, there are people that will now just join the core CDLI team as part of these hackathons, because they have, you know, Catherine, our lead on ASR, has delivered training programs, and a couple of people have just followed along and excelled to the point where we're now, Census Hub and I and CDLI are thinking, well, how do we employ them and how do we build an African base in this area? And I think, if you watch this space, we will have a formal African presence here with in partnership with Census Hub in 2026.
Yeah, I think the Census Hub and Brian have been absolutely outstanding.
They've been fantastic.
I can say anything I like, but they are absolutely brilliant.
They've been brilliant.
And
Gifty too in Gifty Ghana. Too.
But the thing is, you know, we are working on enabling African people to be understood in the languages which they choose to speak in. And on top of that, we are enabling brilliant African minds to use all their amazing skills and make change.
Yeah.
And on top of that, we're enabling brilliant innovators here in Africa to build stuff and help